Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann here with Medical Monday. Today we learn about how emotional trauma can be inherited over generations, reflected in our own anxieties, phobias, and behaviors. My guest today spent years on a personal journey seeking to heal from a stress-related eye injury that turned out to be due in large part to difficult relationships with each of his parents, who in turn were limited by the traumas of their own parents. He made peace with his parents as adults, and through his thoughtful method of applying linguistic understanding to core personal beliefs, he believes that victims of trauma can find happiness and not transmit that trauma to future generations. My guest today is therapist and author Mark Wallin, who's founder of the Family Constellation Institute and author of the new book entitled, It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. Mark Wallin is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Mark Wallin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. I want to start by asking you really simply your premise of trauma being inherited. I mean, it's kind of surprising. On the one hand, I think people and families might know it, but you delve into the science of it. How can trauma be inherited?
When we experience a trauma, it changes us. Literally, it causes a chemical change in our DNA, and this can affect the way our genes function, sometimes for generations. So when we go to have kids, they don't always come with a clean hard drive the way we'd like. There's an operating system that's already in place, and this operating system contains the fallout from our traumas, maybe even our parents' traumas, maybe even our grandparents' or great-grandparents' traumas. So our kids can be born with fears and feelings and symptoms that don't always belong to them, which is why I wrote the book, so we can make this link and break the cycle.
Right, and you postulate that it's three generations, that often trauma from, say, a grandparent's generation can revisit a child, or I would say a grandchild, who may have never even met the grandparent.
Exactly. A lot of the studies coming out right now from major institutions like Mount Sinai Medical in New York or Emory Medical in Atlanta or the Brain Institute in Zurich, the Brain Research Institute, are talking about a three-generational link. In humans, we can see this connection for two generations. In mice and rats, we can see it for three generations. And the reason that they choose to do these studies with mice and rats is we share 99% of the same genetic makeup. So out of 30,000 genes, mice will have 29,700, I'm approximating, of course, similar genetic patterns to humans.
One thing you turned me on to in the book, though, which ties into a lot of, I think, modern popular science, is this idea of non-coding DNA. That is, most of our DNA, which for a long time we thought of as so-called junk DNA, actually seems to have a huge role in how our genes are transcribed. That is, what proteins are actually made, or how genes are regulated for what proteins are ultimately made. And it seems like, at least in inherited trauma, that plays a big role as well.
Yes, they're looking at the non-coding DNA, which, as you point out, they used to call junk DNA, thinking it was mostly useless. But what we're learning is the more sophisticated the organism, humans being at the top of the food chain, of course, the higher the amount of non-coding DNA. And it's in this non-coding DNA where the emotional or behavioral traits are coming from. In fact, they do this very interesting study with mice out of Emory in Atlanta. They take male mice and they introduce the smell of a cherry blossom-like scent. And every time the mouse experiences the scent, it's electrically shocked, so it receives a trauma. And then the traumatized mouse is examined, and they look at the brain, the blood, the sperm, and they find changes in each. In the brain, they find enlarged areas where there would be more smell receptors to be able to detect the smell at lesser concentrations, which is a protective, it's an epigenetic protective device. So it's adaptive. So if the mouse can smell it more quickly, it can then be predisposed to protect itself more readily. They also find changes in the blood and in the sperm. Technically, in the sperm, they find low DNA methylation. And then they take the sperm and they inject it into female mice to impregnate them. And then they take the male offspring. And this is what's interesting. In the next generation, yes, they see those same changes, but they introduce the smell of the cherry blossom scent, and the mouse becomes jittery and jumpy as though it's been traumatized, but it's never experienced the trauma. It just receives the smell. It has the trauma response without having experienced the trauma. The most compelling or the craziest thing is what happened in the next generation. These mice, the grandpups, also experience, just by smelling the cherry blossom scent, the jumpiness, the anxiety, the jitteriness, but they did not have the brain changes and the sperm changes, which led the researchers to say, hey, we're looking at a three-generational link here.
That is really astonishing. I mean, I guess one sort of skeptical question would be, certainly in animal studies, we can say these correlations exist. And of course, we can't necessarily translate that into the human experience. But, you know, share with us what forms of research demonstrate this. And of course, your clinical practice is all about this type of inherited trauma. But what does the research literature in the first part of your book show us about how humans inherit trauma?
So for humans, there's been some very interesting studies that have come out of Mount Sinai Medical in New York. There's a woman, I think she's a rock star, a neuroscientist, a pioneer. Her name is Rachel Yehuda. And she's the first person to look, I believe, at groups of people who've suffered collectively. She looked at the Holocaust survivors and their children, and she found that the children are experiencing similar trauma symptoms like the parents, the anxiety, the depression, as a result of low levels of cortisol, the stress hormone that brings us back to normal after we experience a trauma. And then she looks at another group. She looks at the children, the babies that are born to mothers who were at or near the World Trade Center, who they were pregnant when the World Trade Center was attacked. And these mothers had gone on to develop PTSD and then delivered babies who had what they call secondary PTSD. Again, compromised levels of cortisol, 16 different genetic markers. Just last year, she finds that Holocaust survivors and their children share the same gene pattern, the same gene changes in the same area, in the exact same gene, a particular gene that regulates stress. Technically, it's the FKBP5 gene, but she finds the same gene affected. And so she says this is the first for sure study in humans where they can show a two-generational link. She also says that you and I are three times more likely to have symptoms of PTSD if one of our parents had post-traumatic stress disorder. And as a result, we're likely to struggle with depression and anxiety.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Mark Wallin. He's founder of the Family Constellation Institute and author of the new book entitled, It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. Transitioning to sort of the middle of the book, where you really explain and sort of lay out your methodology, you focus on language really as a key tool, if you will, for how people are able to bring forth really in some ways their most primal fears, but how that enables, I would say us, put myself in that category, as patients or as, you know, people who have experienced trauma to really understand and gain insight over these traumas that we may well have inherited. And so I guess I would start by asking you, you know, to describe for our listeners, you know, what do you mean by core language or core question?
So when a trauma happens, clues are left behind. Clues in the form of emotionally charged words and sentences, words we use all the time to describe our fears, our symptoms, our complaints, even our relationships, even our parents. When we describe what's uncomfortable, we get locked into a feeling that's been there for, who knows, it can be for since we were born, or perhaps even it can be biologically inherited. But I find this language, these language clues, I find it a breadcrumb trail. And if we learn how to follow this breadcrumb trail, it can lead us back to traumatic events, certainly in childhood, but even further into our family history. So that when we know how to uncover these unconscious words, And again, these are words we say all the time. I call it core language, but we could as easily call it a breadcrumb trail of words. And we learn how to link it to these original traumas. It's like finding the missing piece of the puzzle that lets the whole picture come into view and gives us a context that explains why we feel the way we do.
And the book is replete with examples of this. So I'll ask you to share perhaps an example of how this works. And we talked off-air about one of the cases that's actually not in the book, about a young woman who experienced cutting behavior. That is, she was harming herself by cutting. Can you set that up for us?
It was one of my earliest cases before I even really knew what I was looking for. Here was this woman who was cutting herself so deeply. She would cut down to the bone at times. She would cut arteries. She would need to be hospitalized often for infections or blood loss. And one day, as we were working together, I said, "Tell me, what are you thinking right before you cut?" And she looked at me and said, "I deserve to die." Now, here I am looking at a 24-year-old woman whose life has just begun. And I asked the obvious question, "What have you done that you deserve to die?" And she said, "Nothing." I said, "Did you harm somebody? Did you hurt somebody in an accident? Did you break up with somebody and they took their lives?" She said, "No, it's nothing like that." So we began to look around in the family history, and then she dropped the bomb. She told me that her grandmother, an alcoholic, was driving drunk, and her grandfather was in the passenger seat. And grandma, drunk, hit a telephone pole, crashed, lived, but grandpa went through the windshield and got cut and lacerated deeply and bled to death before the ambulance could get there. And in that moment, we both made an astounding connection that language, what I call, again, those breadcrumb trails, that core language, "I deserve to die," that would have been the grandmother's sentence having taken the life of her beloved. "I deserve to die, not him. I'm driving drunk." And then another interesting connection. Here she is, cutting, like the grandfather. And the reason we knew it was effective, a home run, really, is because when we worked with that story in her family, she stopped cutting.
That's a very powerful story, because I know from medical practice that sometimes people who have self-injurious behavior or cutting behavior are some of the hardest folks to treat sometimes. So the story itself of that insight gained leading to a solution to sort of cure the behavior is utterly compelling. And like I said, there are many positive stories of that in the book. And so one question that the book raised for me is, it's presented in a certain way. Is it really that simple? I mean, is insight always enough?
No, insight is not. And as I make the point in the book, insight is just the beginning. Then the whole third of the book is devoted to the practices, the healing practices, and the way that we heal. Let's go back to this woman who's the cutter. Not all cutting will be inherited behavior or inherited experience from a previous generation. It just, in this case, that happened to be true. But to heal, we've got to have an experience. We've got to experience something larger than the trauma feelings, the old habit we have of feeling bad, something that will help us down-regulate the limbic response. And to heal, we've often got to engage other parts of our brain, specifically the prefrontal cortex, which can help us out of these trauma feelings. So many of the exercises in the book teach us a new practice, how to take the healing elements of this case, or the case that we're working with, and how to practice those new feelings. When we practice the new feelings, we create new neural pathways in our brain, what people call neuroplasticity, the plastic brain, the brain that can change. But we need to practice the new feelings from the new experience, which in this woman's case was, she had a conversation with her dead grandmother and with her dead grandfather, and she also had a practice. We worked with her developing a practice of leaving those feelings through breath, through mindfulness. When she would feel the impulse to harm herself, it would be, she'd re-experience a greater feeling of calm or ease. You know, when we visualize an action or take an action, the same regions of the brain become activated as though we were really having that conversation or we were really living that action. So in this woman's sense, in this woman's experience, by practicing, by visualizing, by going deeply into the practice of the new experience, the new feelings in that experience, that it wasn't her that needed to die. It wasn't her that had to be cut. She could change her brain. And when she thought of her grandparents, there was a feeling of peacefulness, rather than in this family, it was a disruptive feeling of angst. I mean, you never talked about this in her family. And that's what I find in many of our families where trauma continues. There's a taboo in the family of talking about the traumas or even letting ourselves heal from them or just laying things out on the table.
That raised the question for me of if families were more open or more communicative, and of course it's delicate, obviously, because some of these things are extremely upsetting, and certainly for young children it would be very upsetting. So knowing the right time to apprise a youngster or a teenager of some past family trauma, that would be a fairly challenging thing to know when to do. But I think it's worth pointing out that the uncanniness, it may have been in the cases that you selected to present, but invariably it seems like there was this significant correlation with age, where the age of a symptom onset or the age where a condition developed seemed to have an incredible, correlation with when one of these untalked about family traumas may have happened with, again, somebody a generation or two generations removed, where, again, the patient, in this case a kid or young person, may not have known about what was going on in their family.
There are definitely telltale signs. We might experience a fear or a symptom that strikes unexpectedly, as you mentioned, at a certain age or when we hit a milestone in our life. For example, as soon as we get married or we go to have a child or we have a child or we get rejected by our love or we move to a new place. I once worked with this woman who was consumed with anxiety as soon as she became a new mother. She didn't have anxiety her whole life, but now that she's a new mother, she's consumed. And I asked her questions that I outline in the book, and she discovered that she had a terrible fear of harming her new baby. So I asked her if anyone in her family had ever harmed a baby, and she said no. And I said, are you sure? And she said no. And then she said, oh my God, my grandmother, as a young woman, accidentally started a house fire. She lit a candle, caught the curtains, but the baby was upstairs, and the mother couldn't get her newborn out of the house. And then the woman told me, and we were never allowed to talk about it. And in that moment, she made the link that she had inherited that feeling from her grandmother, and then she was able to take steps to break the pattern. Well, you talked about ages, and you also talked about how young children, when do we talk about them? There's a case in the book that still strikes me when I think about it. It's a young boy who pulled the hair out on the crown of his head when he reached the age of 7. He literally had a bald spot from how he would pull the hair at the crown of his head. So I said to the mother, I didn't work directly with the boy. She called me and asked if I could help. And I said, sure, let me talk to you, and we'll see if we can find something. And I said, what happened to you or his father or someone in the family around age 7? And the mother said, that would be me. I asked my mom to make me some food, and my mom went down into the kitchen, had an aneurysm, and we found her dead in the kitchen, and I always felt guilty. And she felt so guilty, in fact, that the trauma of feeling responsible for her mom's death, she linked her asking her mom for food to her mom's death, sort of anchored or ingrained, in a sense, if you will, the trauma in the family. So I asked her to tell her little boy about his grandmom, who he didn't know about, who they never talked about, and maybe even to color a picture about grandmom and to make a picture. And we had the insight to look at a book with the image of a halo from some spiritual book or religious book. And because we thought about if the halo is a good feeling at the top of the head, where the boy has this anxious feeling, that if she told him that grandma blessed his head at night and grandma's like a halo, and she actually put a picture of grandma over his bed, showed the boy a picture of a halo, and told him that grandma was blessing his head. So here, every time he would go to pull the hair, he would be met with a pleasant feeling, a good feeling, a new experience of his grandma blessing him. And this was helpful for the boy to stop pulling his hair.
Wow. Mark Willen, you spent many years really seeking your own, well, on your own journey, and in a way, not knowing it, I suppose, at the time, but developing this kind of insight-oriented treatment for, you know, multiple generation trauma. You lay that out sort of in the introduction of the book. I wonder if you'd share with us your version of the events. I mean, you went far and wide, did you not, seeking sort of spiritual and personal enlightenment?
I did, and it was my own language that led me toward my healing. I just didn't know it at the time. Back, 26 years ago, I began to lose the vision in one of my eyes. And I went to the doctors, and I had many tests, and they determined I had an incurable condition, an idiopathic condition called central serous retinopathy, which in many people is self-limiting. But in my case, I had the wet kind, the leaky kind, the 5% of people get that can lead to becoming legally blind. And they told me with the great vision loss that I was having and the amount that it was progressing that I could expect it in the other eye too. And all they could tell me was that they'd seen this condition connected with stress. So here I was looking to heal. They can't help me, and everything I'm trying is making it worse. I'm trying supplements and vitamins and juice fasts and hands-on healing, and everything I'm doing made it worse. And I couldn't run my business anymore. I was a business person at that time because I was losing my eyesight. So I handed the keys to somebody, and I went on a search for healing. And this search led me far and wide, halfway around the globe, to as far as Indonesia, actually studying, learning from some very wise teachers, some masters, and wise men and women, many of whom taught me some profound principles that I would teach later. But I didn't know I'd be teaching anything at the time. I just wanted to be able to see. And one of the teachers told me to go home to heal my relationship with my parents. And I had a very broken relationship with my parents. I didn't realize it at the time, but inherited family trauma stood in the way. Specifically, the fact that my grandparents were all orphaned in some way. Three of my grandparents lost their moms when they were babies or toddlers. And the fourth, she lost her dad when she was one. So ultimately, she loses her mom's attention also. And this feeling of being broken from a mother's love, this is what passed forward in my family. And the anxiety, the terror of feeling that you never are held or taken care of, this feeling of being broken. I remember, oh my goodness, being 5 years old, running into my mom's bedroom when she'd leave the house, pulling open her drawers and thinking I would never see her again. And I dig my hands into her drawers and pull her scarves and her nightgowns to my face, trying to smell her scent, thinking that all I would have left of her is her scent. And I'd never see her again, which is true for my grandmothers and grandfathers. They didn't see their mothers again, except for the one, but had that break. And 40 years later, I said to my mom, "Do you know, when I was 5 years old, I used to run into your bedroom and pull open your drawers and cry into your clothing?" And she looked at me, and this I'll never forget. She looked right at me and said, "You did that too when I left the house? I did the same thing when my mother left the house." And you know the funny thing, John? My sister, who's now reading the book, said, "I did that too." So this pattern of thinking we'd never see our mother again passed forward. And for me, it had somaticized. All the stress that I carried had somaticized into a physical condition, because that's what the doctors told me. They said stress and anxiety, we know to be at the root. We just don't know how it's connected, but we know it's connected with cortisol, which takes us back to really those studies from Rachel Yehuda.
Your mother never gave you any reason to suggest she was going to abandon you, or right? I mean, I understand it's not a conscious thing, but you were paralyzed almost with fear of her, you know, disappearing.
Yes, and then there would have been a reengineering of that trauma in my early days, too. My mom was hospitalized when I was a year old, and also forceps baby and all things like that. But But yes, even without those.
So this teacher told you to go home, and then you were somewhat skeptical, like, why would I do that? But then a second teacher...
I didn't believe him. Surely he misread me. I had been meditating all the time at this point, and I thought he was going to crown me meditator of the year. Instead, I thought I was moments from enlightenment, and he looks right at me. I should say, looked right through me and said, go home and call your parents. So I thought, oh, he must be wrong, and I thought I'd seek out a even better spiritual teacher, a higher one, and I did, and the same thing happened. I got to the front of the line, ready to get a meeting with this guy, and as soon as I'm at the front of the line, he said, go home and make peace with your parents. The same thing, but this time I listened, and making peace with my parents wasn't easy. I had such a broken relationship. I remember walking up the driveway, and I knew my mom was going to hug me, but the usual thing I was afraid would happen, which would be my chest would tighten. It would feel like being squeezed by a bear trap. And that's exactly what happened. She held me and squeezed me, and I thought, oh, my God, I can't breathe. But I told her this time, because I had so much experience with meditating, which was being able to tolerate uncomfortable feelings, that I said, Mom, don't stop. Keep holding me. Because I wanted to learn where and how I tightened and what was really going on and how close connection that had frightened me, where it had come from to heal it. And ultimately I did. I fell back in love with my mom, that when my mom would give me love, it was actually restorative and healing and wonderful. Fell back in love with her and my dad. And that, unbeknownst to me, led to my eyesight coming back. And it's funny, even when I go to the ophthalmologist and he says, read that chart, what's so strange is I read it and he said, you can't see that. Your retina is all scarred. But I do see it. I have 20/20 vision. And what's amazing is the retina. That I can't explain. There's some mysteries that we just can't explain. But I can say healing my relationship with my parents eased my anxiety, made me a much calmer, more grounded person. And in that calm and groundedness, my eyesight came back. And then I started to teach these principles 20 years ago or so, more than that, 23 years ago, because they worked. You know, I always tell people, shake the family tree and see what falls out. What secrets have never been told? What traumas have never healed all the way that could use a little boost? What stories don't get told because of the grief or the sadness or the pain or the anger or the shame or the embarrassment? Why don't these stories get told? And when they don't, it seems to have a inverse effect. You see, we think we're immunizing our children by blocking the past. I'm not going to talk about that. My child doesn't need to know that. But it actually seems to have an inverse effect on whether these traumas are repeated or re-engineered or relived in subsequent generations. And when we do see the next generation struggling, maybe we need to start talking.
The name of the book is It Didn't Start With You, and it's written by my guest today, Mark Wallin. Mark, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, John. I enjoyed talking with you.
Mark Wallin is founder of the Family Constellation Institute and author of the new book entitled It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. Rich Fisher will be back tomorrow. I'll see you next Monday. I'm John Schumann. Thanks for listening.